When are people going to see that nothing ain't never going to change unless somebody finally makes up its mind to stand up and fight? Damn.
Netroots Radio presents Hopping Mad with Will McLeod and Arliss Bunny. Now, here's Will and Arliss.
Welcome to Hopping Mad. I'm Will McLeod.
And I'm Arliss Bunny, and so glad to be back with you this week.
Today, we are having sort of a roundtable show. We're here with one half of a reverent testimony, Rachel Hutchinson. Rachel, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So, since we're doing kind of a roundtable, we all brought some topics we'd like to discuss, and I wanted to talk about climate change and our reaction to it, what I feel is our insufficient reaction to it. And this has really been on my mind because my family is from Florida and I grew up in Florida. And there's currently a hurricane hitting Florida. We're recording this on Sunday afternoon at about 2 o'clock, so the storm hasn't quite made landfall. But what it has roared through the Keys at this point, but we're not sure what's going to happen when it does make landfall. Now, when Hurricane Andrew hit Florida, I was living about in the area where Irma's projected to come ashore. I was living in a town called Riverview, which is right next to Tampa, on the Alifi River. And even though Hurricane Andrew hit 200 miles away from where we were, the Alifi still overflowed its banks. And I remembered, you know, we all slept in the hallway because we didn't have any boards for the windows and we just wanted to be safe. We didn't think we were going to get that much of a wind issue, and none of our windows were broken. But I remember waking up the next morning and walking to the back door and seeing that the water from the river that had overflowed its banks was just lapping at our steps, essentially. We were on an island in the middle of a lake that, you know, had been created by this river overflowing its banks. And it you know, kind of shocked me that we were being hit by this storm and we were on the other side of the state from Miami and significantly north. I mean, Riverview, again, is right next to Tampa. It's in that area. And what worries me about the storm surge from this is that the West Coast is a lot flatter. The East Coast of Florida has sort of the spine of Florida, this coral ridge running along it that keeps a lot of it up above water. And the West Coast doesn't. It has a lot of just plains. So if we flooded and flooded badly when there wasn't a significant hit from Andrew, I'm worried about that area when there is a significant hit from Andrew. And I'm also really worried about folks down in the Keys, because all day on Saturday I was watching the live feed from the southernmost point at Key West, and there were people who were just out in the hurricane having fun getting knocked over by storm surge. And I'm really worried that because Florida hasn't had a serious hit in a long time, that a lot of folks are just not taking this storm seriously, in the same way that we don't take climate change seriously. And so I'm very worried about the results of this storm, even after we saw what happened in Texas. And it's really gotten me thinking about how we react to climate change and to disasters and to threats. And, you know, I was looking at the history of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, of FEMA, and it went back to the Department of Civil Defense. And civil defense was disassembled because it had been pretty heavily politicized. One of the roles, and Arliss, I don't know if you remember this sort of thing, but my reading is telling me that civil defense seemed to be trying to convince Americans that we could somehow survive a nuclear war. And that it played a really
yeah.
political role
Duck in and
trying
cover.
To convince yeah, that we know we'll all be fine. And that's what civil defense was doing, rather than what I think should be the role for an organization like that, which is preparing Americans for disasters. I mean, that kind of organizing, you know, how do we evacuate during a hurricane? Those sorts of things would be very useful in relation to natural disasters. In relation to those three fires, Eagle Creek, Latuna, and the South Fork fire that are going out on the West Coast that we're talking about. And so as I've just kind of looked at this, I really think that we need more preparedness training, and I'd like something like civil defense to come back, but not about, you know, nuclear war, about natural disasters. Because we know...
Can I ask you a question?
Go ahead.
Is that sort of FEMA's role now, or is that just a totally defunct organization? Like, is that just not a thing anymore? Or has their role sort of been folded into FEMA or other organizations? They just got rid of it, or?
Well, the role that civil defense played has been absorbed by Homeland Security and FEMA. But there's a big chunk of stuff that was done, organizing volunteers.
Well, and the National Guard.
Yeah, the National Guard as well. Mm-hmm. But we had a lot of civilian volunteers and citizen volunteers who were all set up to take certain steps in disaster scenarios, and specifically, as far as civil defense is concerned, in nuclear war scenarios, who would man shelters and stuff like that and knew where to go, and people stored supplies in their homes, and there was a lot of stuff like that they would do. And if we did that for disaster scenarios, for hurricane scenarios, if we had people who were pre-designated volunteers who fulfilled those sorts of roles, we don't have that today, but we could. And we could do community resiliency, and we could have emergency food supplies and emergency shelters and stockpiles of various materiel that, if there's a disaster a couple of towns over, you've already got the supplies to send. You don't need to have the food drive. You've already got the food.
Well, some of that is already in place with the American Red Cross. And, of course, the point there is that it's moved outside of government.
Yeah, but at the same time, the American Red Cross has issues and distribution issues and other problems.
Oh, yeah.
I think
cost issues and lots of other issues.
Yeah.
We were just talking about that on the podcast yesterday about, you know, the sort of controversy around the American Red Cross, which is that, you know, the percentage of donations that actually go to help people in certain areas is pretty low in terms of their administrative costs and what they're able to actually do and to mobilize. And we had a conversation about perhaps donating to more local organizations, to your point that, you know, we don't need to bring in a national organization when there are people who are there, who are nearby, who already have the infrastructure in place and the organization to really make a huge difference in the immediate aftermath.
Yeah. And
but part of it is, I think Will is right when he was talking earlier, though, about community resiliency and individual personal resiliency, because when I was young, there really was a push in like the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts and in churches and in all kinds of organizations. They had lists and little booklets and things on what you should have in your home or apartment or whatever to get you through a given period of time. Under the assumption that stuff happens. And, you know, that, you know, I think it originally came from the idea of war, but in California, where I'm from, that netted out to what happens in a major earthquake.
Yeah.
And I went through a couple of major earthquakes where resources were not readily available for a period of time, and power and that kind of thing was down for an extended period of time, that sort of thing. And, you know, my dad, Mr. Always, Always, Always Prepared, you know, rolled out the supplies and the, you know, the Coleman stove and the, you know, and the family was fed and we had, you know, everything we needed. But that basic education, I mean, some of that education happened in the schools, and that education doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, it needs to. And let me just describe for our listeners.
Hold on, really, just for one second, though. I would say that's absolutely true. And for people that are able to do that, they should. but I don't want to minimize the idea that some people are not able to do that financially, or because their homes are not available. You know, there are people that the government has a role in this.
Which is why community resiliency
needs to help people.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So while everyone that's able to do those things should absolutely do them, and maybe, you know, stock up for your neighbor too if you can.
Right.
For the people who aren't able to do that, that's the role of government for me. Like, if we can agree on anything across all aisles, when stuff like this happens, the government's role is to step in and help.
Yeah, and
for the people who can't help themselves.
Except
that's one of the whole points of community resiliency. Yeah. If everybody is stocking up on food and everybody is working together as a community to have their own food stockpiles, then you have enough resiliency that, you know, if my house is okay and I get to go to the grocery store and, you know, there's supplies, but your house has been devastated, I've got some food and blankets that I can give my next door neighbor so my next door neighbor doesn't starve.
Yeah.
Like the idea of community resiliency isn't just doing it for ourselves, but doing it so that when the storm is over, if my town isn't hit and the next town over is, and the next town over is in trouble, then we send our supplies to the next town. That's part of the basic idea of this, is that if it's everywhere, then the nearby communities can give because they've already got the resources to be able to give. In that
right.
kind of scenario.
And we're not looking at some sort of national organization coming in late and trying to, you know, organize. We're looking at your neighbors. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah, because if a local seaside community gets knocked out by a storm and their grocery stores are all damaged and inundated, then the inland communities can then say, we've got our own emergency supplies and hand them over. And I mean, I think that's part of it. And let me just describe what it was like growing up in Florida with my own family that's super be prepared.
Can I hop in for just 1 second?
Yeah.
And say that before we kind of get off this corner of the topic, that all three of us today are going to bring up topics whereby there's an extreme empathy deficit on the other side of the aisle. And remember that when Sandy hit New York and New Jersey, the Texas delegation voted against aid. So when you talk about everybody can agree across the aisles, no, they can't. Conservatives voted against helping people in New York and New Jersey because they were in blue states. And maybe my favorite picture of last week was Chris Christie losing his mind in basically saying, I told you so, to the Texas congressional delegation.
Yeah.
And I don't think just that it was in the North or in blue states. I think that this pernicious idea of the liberal elite on the East Coast caused a lot of that animosity and inability to vote for relief for Sandy. And it's not just that it's blue states, right? It's this notion that we have, that there's the South and there's rural areas and then there's the liberal elites in the Northeast. And to Chris Christie's point, when he was losing his mind, he said, you know, this wasn't about hurricane relief or anything else. This was about Ted Cruz and this delegation trying to be the most conservative people that they could be. And it was purely political. And I think he's right. And now they're facing a storm that's of a magnitude much larger than Sandy, but now they're like, oh no, we definitely need help. And it's I think that, you know, it's interesting to look at the politics of it, right? The liberal elites don't get money, but Houston, obviously we need help. And if you strip away the politics of it, they would never have done that. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But politically, they did make that decision because I don't think they actually care about the United States the way that people are supposed to or the way that we historically have. There's nothing particularly American about the modern Republican Party, and there's nothing, honestly, particularly small R Republican about the current Republican Party. They're all about, I've got mine, to hell with the rest of you. That is the way they see the world. And they would argue that individuals should be the ones to do their own preparing, and they don't need advice and they don't need help. And if they, you know, don't do this for themselves, then, you know, they deserve what's coming to them. That's the way they tend to see
until
the world.
Until it hits their community. And then they're like, no, we need all the help.
Yeah. Right. And right? That's exactly
that's, it. And, right. People in New York better figure it out. People in Texas need help.
Yeah. Well, but that's because the people in Texas are good Republican conservatives who've suffered a tragedy, whereas the people in New York asked for God's punishment by having gay marriage be acceptable or something.
Right. I mean, well, and you heard Ann Coulter, right? The reason that the hurricane hit Houston is because they've got a lesbian mayor.
Yep.
Honestly, I feel like she's just trolling at this point, but that stuff still floats around, you know?
I liked the, I don't remember the name of the actor who played Hellboy, but his reaction was, Anne, you're supposed to take your antipsychotics with food. With food, Anne. was his response to
Perlman,
that.
Right?
Perlman, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Perlman. I love him. But, become a weird,
I mean, the thing that gets me right now is, and I'd like an answer to this question as far as the Florida disaster scenario that we have is, one of the largest disaster evacuations we've ever had because it's going to hit most of Florida. Like the storm is going up the coast of Florida. And this is a storm that is roughly the size of Germany. Like I saw an image this morning of it superimposed over Germany for Central European audiences to understand the sheer size of this storm. And so it's going to hit. It's hitting Miami right now, even though it's on the other side of the state from Miami. They're still seeing storm surge on the East Coast. And so it's the largest evacuation that we've done in a long time. I heard people calling it the largest emergency evacuation in the U.S. ever. I'm not sure if that's the case, but I wouldn't be surprised. And we ended up with a gas store shortage. So we ended up in a situation where you had the Florida Highway Patrol escorting gas trucks so that people could have a supply of fuel. And, you know, despite the fact that this was something that, you know, my family always feared. And so when we were kids, I would remember we'd have about 7 jerry cans in our garage, just full of gas. Which
what
was
is
enough.
A jerry can?
It's a 5-gallon gas can.
It's a military term for a gas can.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
We'd have a stock.
I grew up in Colorado, so.
We'd have a stockpile of jerry cans. We'd have an extra tank of gas, essentially, stored during hurricane season so that if we were trying to, you know, leave Florida and were running out of gas and needed to get out of a hurricane zone and there just wasn't a place to stop for gas, we could pull over, fill up the car, and keep going. And the smell really, really annoyed my mother, I remember, because it was, you know, you'd walk into you'd walk into the garage and you could just smell the gasoline, and that was irritating. But, you know, we did that because we thought we needed to, and we feared a situation like this. But our response to there's a gas storage isn't, well, that's why you have a jerry can. It's, isn't it terrible that there's a gas shortage? This shouldn't be allowed to happen. Just because we prepared for it doesn't mean that we're going to hate the people who didn't. And I don't understand.
Right. So weren't able to. Yeah.
Because what if we hadn't prepared? What if we hadn't had the time? What if we were, you know, from a family where
people
are working three jobs?
What if you lived in an apartment and there's nowhere to put the gas can?
Yeah.
Right.
Your whole house will, I mean, you know, everybody doesn't have a garage.
Right. Well, that's my current situation. I prepare for hurricanes or prepared for them in New York City. I have a can for water. I have a 5-gallon can for water, but I don't have a gas can because I don't have a place to put a gas can.
Yeah.
It's not something that you'd want to store in a hot car and just drive around with it inside the car.
No.
Because
or stick in your closet in your house in your apartment. Like, that's not a thing that you can do.
No, it's really not. So,
yeah.
I mean, we need to think about community resiliency as far as that's concerned. And the same thing is true of, we were going to talk about of climate change as it relates to these wildfires out west, which you folks know a little bit more than I do about.
Yes.
So
the Eagle Creek fire up at the Columbia River Gorge has actually jumped the Columbia River Gorge, which, if you've ever been there and seen that, is nearly unfathomable.
It's astounding, right? Have you been there?
It's astounding. sparks
like
are carrying
the ocean. I mean, it's like I can't imagine a fire jumping it. I've been there. I lived in Oregon. I can't imagine a fire jumping it. It's crazy.
Sparks are carrying up to 12 miles and starting spot fires. So it's staggering, the size of that fire. The South Fork Fire at Yosemite National Park is threatening Wawona, and the old Wawona Hotel has had to be evacuated. And Glacier National Park has lost the Sperry Chalet, which was built in 1913, and in the Sprague Fire. The Sprague Fire has completely took the Sperry Chalet, I think, last night. And that fire, along with the South Fork Fire, are expected to burn all the way until rain falls and temperatures get cold, whenever that is. The La Tuna Fire in L.A. is the largest fire L.A. County has ever faced. And that's saying something, because we've all seen, you know, the nightly news pictures of L.A. burning. Fortunately, so far, only 5 homes, I believe, have been lost to the La Tuna Fire, which is an extraordinarily low number for a big L.A. County fire. But make no mistake, this is... The West is burning more than it ever has in the past. And the National Fire Service and, you know, all the attendant support are trying to fight it on a lower budget, because the budget was cut by about 30%. And they are, you know, trying to bring in money from other places. But of course, that hasn't been successful. Western congressional leaders tried to tie in fire funding into funding for Harvey and weren't successful. So we'll see if it gets tied into some of the aid for, all of the aid that it's going to take to recover from this, you know, from the current hurricane, from Jose that's bearing down right behind that. You know, this is, you know, I would love to be able to say we're going to get through this awful season and it's not going to happen again. And wow, what a terrible thing to go through. But and it'll take us, you know, years, decades to recover, but we'll rebuild. Except that then there's next year. And there's no guarantee that next year isn't going to be as bad or worse. In fact,
so
it's
I have
likely
things to say about that. Like, number one, I live in Colorado, and we don't have any fires currently, although we are historically
prone to them. That's a little miraculous, actually.
It is, actually. But the last week, particularly the last 4 or 5 days, we've all been noting that there's this sort of haze in the sky. You know, you look up and you're used to a blue sky in Colorado, and there isn't a blue sky. The sun is a little bit dimmer, and everything's a little bit, like, orange. And I didn't realize why. I was like, what is going on? Like, it looks like dusk and it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And what I realized was, and what I found out was, that the smoke from the fires from the Northwest have traveled to Denver and have actually made the breathing conditions and the sky in Denver, Colorado, which is pretty central in the United States, overcast. There's so many fires and so much smoke that it's traveled to Denver, and our sky for the last 4 or 5 days has been a little orange, and it looks like dusk all the time. And there are no fires here, which is astounding for me.
My parents live just north of the San Francisco Bay Area, and their air quality, and, you know, there's been just a huge amount of smoke in the air. They've basically been staying inside for the last couple of weeks because the Oregon fires are so bad in terms of smoke down where they are.
Right. They compared it to Mount St. Helens in terms of the, like, ash and stuff that's on the West Coast. But it's astounding to me that in Denver, like in Colorado, our sky is orange all day because of fires that are happening in the Northwest. That's never happened to my knowledge in my lifetime. Yeah. That there's so much fire and so much smoke that is not in my state that has come over and has affected my state. The second thing I would say about all of this is, you know, looking at the hurricanes and the fires and the inspiring stories that are coming out of this is that America doesn't have a lack of heroism in the face of these hurricanes and these massive chest-high floods and all of that stuff. We don't have a lack of heroism, but we have a lack of commitment in the future. So I was talking to my dad about this, and he was saying, you know, if I had a boat and I was in Texas, I'd be out there about the Harvey stuff, right? And that's all fine and good, but I asked him, you know, what I don't need you to do that. What I need you to do is care in 5 years or 2 years. You know, this is Houston. This is an entire city. It's the fourth most populous city in the country. And these people are going to need help beyond, you know, when waters dry out and there is no more stunning news footage of these people wading through water and rescuing people. What we lack is not courage and heroism. What we lack is empathy in the long term.
And a long-term memory, yeah.
That's right, and the long-term memory. These people are going to need help for years. You know, the hot weather dries up the rain, but it doesn't rebuild your house. And I need people to be compassionate and remember how bad it was, and then think about what the aftermath of that is. Because it's not just, oh, well, the water's gone, everything's fine. The water's gone, everything is ruined, right? And so what we lack, what we don't lack in heroism and courage, we lack in long-term memory. And that's the thing I think that we have to remember with Irma and Harvey and all of this is it's going to take years and maybe decades to rebuild these communities. And the government has a role in that, and we have to support that effort.
Well, another thing that bothers me about this is we're talking about the rebuilding effort, but we're not talking about, you know, preparing for the next storm or the next fire. We can prepare for, you know, the conditions that are going to get worse because of climate change. We can prepare for these storms, but we can't do it 5 days before the storm is going to hit. We have to do it years beforehand. We need to not just rebuild. We need to focus on making sure that these sorts of things don't happen again. Well, when these things happen, that we're ready for them. And we haven't done any of that work, because Republicans are more concerned about the budget deficit than they are actually making sure the United States runs properly.
Yeah, the budget deficit, an entirely immaterial number.
Yeah. But I agree with you that these folks are going to need help and funding for years, both to repair what's been lost and to prepare for what's coming next.
Right. And I think a lot of hay was made, you know, a lot of people said, well, it's Texas or, you know, it's Florida. And they're the kind of, you know, backwards Republican weirdos that saw this coming or deserve it. Right. There was some of that stuff coming out pre-Harvey. And now's not the time for that. You know,
exactly.
Yes, Texas and Florida are pretty backwards politically for me. However, there are American citizens and human beings that live in these states. And regardless of how you feel about Texas or Florida, there are human beings that live there that are going to need our help.
That's exactly right.
To your point, Will, you're exactly right. It's not, there's a rebuilding effort, but there's also needs to be a thing that's like, what happens when this happens again? This is not like a shocking surprise that this happened. Right?
Yeah.
Meteorologists said this is going to happen, and we didn't listen, and we didn't do anything, and we didn't make any preparations, and so it was absolutely devastating.
And so next year, and next year, and next year. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it keeps going and going and going. Yeah.
Rachel, let's switch up topics. You have a topic was just infuriates me to my very core. So why don't you go ahead and start?
Well, I would like to talk about the Satanic Temple, which, if you don't know what it is, sounds very controversial and very awful. But in effect is a really effective political organization that exists.
They're amazing.
The Satanic Temple, they are amazing. So you're going to see, every time you hear about stuff like, oh, there was a nativity scene that was set up at a courthouse, right? And the people that protest that, that's the Satanic Temple. People, Texas tries to make abortion illegal through nefarious means, and the Satanic Temple comes in and sues. So I just want to talk about, this is in my mind because they are going to the Missouri Supreme Court tomorrow, actually, is their first opening arguments for a case about abortion. And their defendant, or their plaintiff, I guess, is Mary Doe, a woman who had tried to have an abortion in Missouri and was not able to because Missouri has some pretty barbaric laws. One of which is she had to wait 72 hours, right? The waiting period. And the other one is she was given a bunch of propaganda about life begins at conception, and she was forced to have an ultrasound and all of this stuff. So the Satanic Temple is suing on her behalf because they violated her religiously held beliefs. What's so interesting about the Satanic Temple is that it sounds super crazy, right? It sounds like a bunch of people worshiping Satan are suing. It's not that. It's a very political, secular, humanist organization that uses the same laws that religious organizations use in court for their own religion. So Hobby Lobby...
It right? turns religion back on religion, which is why I love it so much, and why their the battles that they fight, that they have to fight, infuriate me so much.
Hobby Lobby, right, famously used the Religious Freedom Restoration Act from 1988 to say that they did not have to provide birth control for their employees because it violated their sincerely held religious beliefs. They won that case. And so the Satanic Temple, which we call, we'll just say TST from here on out, TST came in and said, great. Well, the court has decided that your sincerely held religious beliefs can be the foundation for many lawsuits. And so in the cases coming up in Missouri, they are, so... up for a second. The Satanic Temple is not like a they've done their very best to make themselves an actual religious organization in terms of the law. Right? So this is not just a group of weirdos that's like, oh, you can do it, I can do it. Like they've made themselves in as much a church as any other church has. And that's why they're able to use this Religious Freedom Restoration Act to their benefit. And so in Missouri, they are saying that what happened to Mary Doe, who was trying to get an abortion, violated two of their sincerely held religious beliefs. I'm going to read you the seven tenets, and you may be a Satanist and not know it. and then I'm going to tell you the two that were violated. So there are seven fundamental tenets of Satanism. Number one, one should strive to act with compassion and empathy toward all creatures in accordance with reason. Number two, the struggle for justice is an ongoing and necessary pursuit that should prevail over laws and institutions. Number three, one's body is inviolable, subject to one's own will alone. Number four, the freedoms of others should be respected, including the freedom to offend. To willfully and unjustly encroach upon the freedom of others is to forego your own. Number five, beliefs should conform to our best scientific understanding of the world. We should take care never to distort scientific facts to fit our beliefs. Number six, people are fallible. If we make a mistake, we should do our best to rectify it and resolve any harm that may have been caused. And number seven, every tenet is a guiding principle designed to inspire nobility in action and thought. The spirit of compassion, wisdom, and justice should always prevail over the written or spoken word. So to be a Satanist is to believe that those things matter.
That's really quite brilliant.
I can't, isn't it?
Yep.
And it explains why their political activity is the way that it is. So in the case of Mary Dill in Missouri, they're arguing that the third tenet, one's body is inviolable, subject to one's own will alone, has been violated by the law that this person can't just go and have an abortion at will. This person has gone in, has requested this act to happen upon their body, and they have been denied that act for 72 hours. The second thing that they say is in violating their sincere religious belief is that the fifth one, which is beliefs should conform to our best scientific understanding of the world. We should take care never to distort scientific facts to fit our beliefs. And on that, they point to the propaganda that's given to women in Missouri about abortion. And the propaganda that's given to them is about how life begins at conception, and it's all religiously based, right? It's not scientifically based at all. And in fact, the science behind the 72-hour waiting time shows that it doesn't actually reduce the number of abortions that happen. And so in order for the government to enact a law that violates the First Amendment of the Constitution, which is the argument they're making, they have to have there has to be a reason that they're doing it, and there has to be proof that what they're doing is under the strictest limits, and they haven't done that. And so the Satanic Temple is suing Missouri and saying these things violate our sincerely held religious beliefs. As much as the baker doesn't want to bake a cake for a gay couple, you cannot tell a woman that she has to wait 72 hours and read these materials and be violated with, an ultrasound, right?
Right.
So they're sort of flipping the script. And in the Constitution, there is no, the whole point is that Christianity isn't the religion, right?
Yeah,
My
only concern about this is that it's flipping the script, but it isn't a script we should be using at all. You know, I very much value and appreciate the meat of what they're doing and why they would choose to do it this way. But at the same time, I believe in this separation of church and state, and that religion is at all being used is problematic for me.
Yeah, I agree completely.
I agree completely with that. But one of the things I wanted to add to that about flipping the script on Christianity, these folks always like to call the United States a Christian country. But the resource for everybody who's listening to this right now, who wants to understand what our founding fathers actually believed, you should look at the Treaty of Tripoli between the United States and the Barbary States in, I think it was 1797, one of the first treaties the United States signed. And it says, since the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, no religious decision will ever affect the relationship between the United States and the Tripoli States. Which,
imagine that.
It's an important bit of history, but there are these folks who are misusing the rights were granted in the Constitution to erode that separation of church and state. And
yes, and that's their entire point, right?
Yeah.
Like one of the other things they did beyond reproductive rights is there was a Ten Commandments thing in Oklahoma, like a I don't want to call it a statue, but it's like the Ten Commandments are written on this big block of things at an Oklahoma courthouse. And the TST came and said, great, so we believe in the separation of church and state. Clearly, Oklahoma does not believe in that. So if we're going to have religion in the courthouse, let's have diversity of religion. And so they crowdfunded this Baphomet statue, which is like a Christian demon with two children and a wall, right? There's a giant wall that separates the Baphomet statue from the Ten Commandments thing. And it went to court, and there's nothing they can say. If you can have a Ten Commandments statue, then you can have a Baphomet statue, right?
Absolutely.
They're just legally, there's nothing you can do. So what they did ultimately was take down the Ten Commandments statue in order to prevent the Baphomet statue from happening. They are incredibly effective because they're using the exact legal framework and the exact language that the evangelical right are using, just on a different religion. And there's nothing you can say, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing that judges and courts and laws can say that that's not as valid. And it pisses people off an awful lot, but I love them the most for it.
Yes, I do. What I worry about, I think, over the long run, other than just the crazy of having to make this fight at all, is that the reality is,
yeah.
What history tells us is that the pendulum will swing back. And as much as religion is being shoved down the throat of this nation in, and many, many, many unwilling people, there is we talk about anger building up in this country. There is an anger building up against religion. And if we think there were church burnings in the past, I think we ain't seen nothing yet. I think there will be a point in time in, a decade, 15 years, maybe 20 years, when the lid blows and churches burn. And the problem with that is that I do think that people of sincerely held religious belief have a right to believe that in safety and security and peace. And I don't think they're going to have that when the worm turns. So, one of the reasons, I think it was Thomas Jefferson who said, the reason for separating, or the reason for keeping religion out of, the founding basis for this country was to protect it.
Yes, from government intervention. Absolutely.
That's right.
Absolutely. But it's also to not make us, Rome.
Yes.
Separation from and separation, protection from and protection to are two different clauses of the First Amendment, right?
Right.
We protect religion from government, but we also protect government from religion. We have to do both of those things. Government should not be influenced by religion, and religion should not be affected by government. Where we get lost is when we get these people who come in with their religion and want to legislate it. And that's the protection from, right? I'm trying to protect people from religion in this country, and that's what the TSC is doing. But I agree with you. We also need to protect religion from government. Government should not have undue influence over religion. You shouldn't be punished for believing a certain way or behaving a certain way or having a certain religion. But those two things are both separate but need to be protected.
Right.
I think one of the main issues that the churches are having right now is that people like me, who are not, super right wing, are feeling more and more unwelcome in the churches we grew up in.
Yeah.
Because the activities of those churches. I have, I've been a Methodist for a really long time in my life. I haven't been to a Methodist church in years because I simply don't feel welcome in them. Even the ones that are the reconciling communities that are designed to be LGBT friendly. Because of the action of the larger institution, I don't really feel welcome in this church that I grew up in anymore. And I don't really feel like going to some other denomination like the UCC that's going to be perfectly welcoming, but that doesn't believe what I believe when it comes to various theological points. And so I feel like one of the things that's happening to religion is as it gets more extreme, as the Methodist Church walks away from its tradition of fighting for social justice and civil rights and embraces conservative ideology, as this sort of thing continues to happen, you're going to see the erosion of membership like we've been seeing over the past few decades. And at a certain point, people are just going to say, you know what? I don't think it's going to be burnings. I think it's going to be tax them. They're operating as businesses, tax them. If they step out of line, they lose their nonprofit status. if they do anything, there, I think it's going to be an illegal erosion that you're going to see. And it's going to be happening because the churches are not willing and haven't been willing to let well enough alone. I mean, they're complaining that certain churches are now being forced to stop, owning bookstores because they're worried about, you know, somebody might want a gay marriage in one of their facilities. And they keep like putting out these horror stories to them that, oh, we are so badly persecuted. When the reality is, the reason people are fighting these churches legally is because they won't leave anybody else alone. And that they built that up into a persecution complex where it's not their actions attacking people that are incorrect. It's everybody else's actions defending themselves that are the problem. And so I don't think it's going to be burnings, but I think there's going to be a legal response.
Yeah, you could very well be right. That makes perfectly good sense.
Yeah.
Well, my subject for today is something we'll get into in Extra Mad, but I just wanted to kind of introduce it here real quickly so people will know what's coming up. I wanted to talk about DACA, but I wanted to do it from kind of a different perspective. I really wanted to set aside talking about, the fact that it's morally wrong because it's just extraordinarily cruel, that it's historically unfounded because, without exception, immigration has proved to be both a short and long-term positive for the U.S., and that it is unfounded racially unless you happen to be 100% Native American. And I don't think too many of the people who are complaining about DACA fall into that group. And, you know, frankly, folks who are 100% Native American have a whole genocide argument to be making, so I don't think they're pretty much worrying about DACA. And the other argument, you know, you hear is the, you know, breaking the law thing. Don't give me the breaking the law thing. If you've ever, for instance, knowingly, you know, gone above the speed limit or, you know, cheated a little bit on your taxes or, I mean, people break rules all the time. People break laws all the time. And you can't give me these people broke the law argument unless, you know, take the log out of your own eye, basically. So Bryce Covert from the New Republic talks about DACA is hiding racism behind economics. And I don't think that's really quite right. I think I want to talk about DACA from an economic perspective, but I really think that DACA is hiding racism behind racism. And how to talk about DACA, but none of that matters, right, in what I'm about to say, because when you're trying to have a DACA conversation with folks who support rescinding DACA, who are conservative and support rescinding DACA, they don't care about anything I just said. None of those things matter. What they care about is how it affects them. And they're making what Bruce Covert is calling an economic argument. And I'm about, in Extra Mad, to come back and give you the why it's not an economic argument, or why actually it is an economic argument, but in the opposite direction. And I wanted to phrase this and talk about it in terms of Rachel, because over a period of time, listening to Irreverent Testimony, I've heard Rachel refer to conversations she's had with her father and her brother and how hard it is to talk about progressive issues with the two of them. So I thought about, as I was putting this together, if I were talking to, you know, Rachel's dad, or basically, you know, one of my neighbors down the street, how would I talk about DACA to them? What would be the things that I think might get through or at least be heard? I don't know that they would change their minds. You know, very few people are actually changing their mind on anything these days, but just to even be heard as, you know, a tiny voice in the background, I was trying to think of what those things would be. And so that's what I've put together. And in speaking with Rachel about this yesterday, she went and had a conversation with her dad. So Rachel, do you want to talk a little bit about that before we head to Extra Mad?
Sure. Sure. I, in preparing for this podcast, just texted him yesterday and said, do you have a minute? I want to talk to you about politics stuff, because we talk about politics all the time. We argue about them mostly since I was about 11 years old. And he said, sure. And so I called him and we had a conversation, and it was not what I thought it would be. When I asked him about DACA and these dreamers and these kids, his opinion was very interesting. It was, I don't think Trump will actually do it. And that really? Was shocking to me. He said, you know, I know he talks a big game about DACA, but I don't think he's actually going to deport these kids. You know, I think he's just putting Congress to the test to say, you need to figure out this immigration problem. And we got into a larger conversation about immigration, and he had, you know, the standard talking points that you'd imagine he'd have, which are awful. But when it came to DACA, I was really surprised that he said, you know, no, he's not going to really deport these kids. He's not going to do that. That's cruel and inhumane. And I said, but that's what he ran on, right? Like, that's,
you voted for him. That's what you,
that's
yeah.
what he said. Yeah. It's the same as healthcare, right? Like, these people all in West Virginia who voted for Trump, and then he's like, let's repeal Obamacare. And they're like, oh, wait, that's my health care. You can't do that. He can't really do that, right? He's not going to really do that. It's this odd dichotomy of like, well, yeah, he said that because he knew that's what he wanted to hear, but he's not actually going to do it. And that to me was the most stunning thing, was I don't believe what he says he's going to do is what he's actually going to do.
So does your dad want DACA to, I mean, does he want those kids to be able to stay himself personally? Would he like those kids to be able to stay, the dreamers?
Yes, some of them. He's very unclear. So it's like, well, you know, I'm talking about my friend that I know who is a dreamer. And he's like, well, of course she should stay. She doesn't know anywhere else and she didn't do anything wrong, right? And I'm like, right. That's my whole argument. That's the whole reason I'm calling you, is to argue that point. And you're saying, of course you should stay. And I'm asking you why you voted for this man. Right? And his argument is, essentially, I don't believe he'll actually do it. I don't believe he'll actually deport 100,000 children. And I'm like, why? Why? Why do you believe that? He said he was going to, have Jed Sessions come out and say, that's exactly what we're going to do. And you're in this fantasy world of course he won't do that because it's cruel.
Jeff Sessions with a smile on his face. Literally.
Yes. 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 A smug smile. And his argument is essentially, I don't think he'll do it because it's cruel. And I don't know what exactly to do with that, to be honest. I don't. Like,
I am slightly encouraged that he can dig up enough empathy to understand that it's cruel. I mean, that's
right.
That's a good sign, right?
I was shocked. Right. I was shocked. I was really shocked. I was like, I didn't expect that. I really expected you to tell me about how they broke the law and, you know, the law's the law and all that stuff. And that's what he has to say about their parents, which we should talk about also. But when it comes to the kids, when it comes to my friend that he knows, of course not. That's insane. That's cruel. Why would we do that? And in the same breath is a Trump supporter. And I don't know what to do with that. I don't. Honest to God, I don't. I to this day, and I thought this would be different after having talked to my dad, but to this day, haven't met someone who thinks that we should deport these people. Not a single person. Even among Trump supporters. So I don't know. I don't know.
I actually haven't seen, you know, even kind of looking around generally on Twitter, I didn't really see, it's not like I saw a whole flock of people coming out of the woodwork saying, yeah, kick him out of the country. I mean, even in, you know, the land of the troll, I didn't see that, which may actually be in alignment with what you're seeing right now.
Yeah. It's weird. Like, don't get me wrong. He has an undercurrent of what I like to call casual racism, right? Like, he doesn't want to, like, burn crosses and wear a hood, but he also says things about immigrants in particular that are pretty nefarious. And yet when brought to the question about DACA, he's like, that's insane. Why would you deport these people? They don't know anywhere else. Like, he's using my argument. So what is astounding to me is that even among the people that I know that agree with Trump about most things, they don't agree on this. And yet there is this political will in Washington to do this thing that no one seems to want. No one.
Yep. So why including are American doing business. So,
right.
So we'll come right back on Extra Mad, and we will talk about that at more length, and give Rachel some other discussion points to take back to her dad, and we'll go from there. Thanks so much, Rachel, for joining us today on Hopping
Thank
Mad.
Thank you so much for having me.
Will and I send out our thanks to Netroots Radio, our show's editor, Michelle LeSure, and especially to all of you for joining us today. You can always find the broadcast version of the show on Netroots Radio at 8 a.m. on Mondays, but you can also find the full version, the podcast, on which includes Extra Mad, and that's on our website, imhoppingmad.com. The podcast can be found on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play as well. And we totally love to hear from you and make every effort to answer as soon as we can. If you comment either at our website or ask us something on Twitter, that kind of thing, you'll find us on Twitter at I'm Hopping Mad. Will's on Twitter at WillMcLeod99. And I'm there, obviously, as at Arliss Bunny. Hopping Mad is your place on Progressive Radio for a deep dive down the rabbit hole and out into the weeds. We care about politics, economics, and of course, carrots. And in that, along that line, I want to announce that we have some really exciting new merchandise. It'll be up on the website probably by next week. So you may be able to go there as soon as next week to see it. I found this fabulous artisan and had her make a little flock of ornaments. They're not necessarily Christmas ornaments. They could be left up all year long. One of them is a deficit owl. So for all of you MMT folks, I have Thurston Owl, the deficit owl. And he's wearing a little cape with a dollar sign. He's very cute. And then there's Arliss Bunny. And she is wearing a little scarf that is in the McLeod Scottish family tartan. So that is our Hopping Mad, sort of our official Hopping Mad ornament. Both of them are really, really fun, and we hope you like them. We'll get them up on the website as soon as we can. And that's just, you know, a little silliness to to go about the day with. We'll be back with Extra Mad, and next up is K-Grow in the Morning here on Netroots Radio. We're back on Hopping Mad. This is Extra Mad. We have Rachel Hutchison with us. And Rachel has been telling us about the conversation she had with her dad as it relates to DACA and rescinding DACA. And it turns out that her dad had kind of a surprising response, which is, I think, hopeful, actually.
He's against it. Yeah. Yeah. It was so shocking. I mean, my dad wants the wall, you know, my dad wants the wall. He wants immigration to be fixed. He wants, you know, Mexicans are stealing our jobs. He's all that stuff. And when I talked about DACA, he was surprisingly not for it. I mean, he just was like I said, I have this friend who's a dreamer, and of course she should stay here. Where are you going to put her? You're going to send her to some country she's never known? And I'm like, oh my God. Yeah. Right. That's right. That's what I was going to say to you.
Well, I'm about to,
no, of course. Like,
I'm about to give you four more bullets in that gun. So beyond having a little bit of empathy, I'm about to give you four more bullets to take back to your dad, to talk about why not only DACA is, important for him and of advantage to him, but why it is of advantage to all of us. And So the first thing I'm going to talk about is something called the labor lump fallacy. So think of like a boa constrictor or something, you know, the labor lump fallacy. The idea with the labor lump fallacy is that when people talk about immigration, they say exactly what you just said your dad said and exactly what Jeff Sessions said, which is that they're taking jobs Native Americans could be filling, right? They're taking jobs away from us. That's what those folks believe. But in order to believe that, they have to believe this thing called the labor lump fallacy. And the labor lump fallacy is the assumption that inside of the economy, there are a fixed number of labor hours or jobs, right? There's only X amount. And if people come in from the outside and take some of X, you know, X minus Y, then you have a smaller, not, you know, what you've got left is smaller. Well, that's not how it actually works. That is not the case because population creates jobs. It always creates jobs. 1.2 jobs are created for every immigrant. Think about that. Wow. Every person that comes into the country, 1.2 jobs are created. So if they take one of them, there's still 0.2 jobs. And not everybody who comes in works, right? Because some of them are older, some of them are kids. Right. So not all of those people are working. The next thing is, between 1970, and when you're explaining the labor lump fallacy, between 1970 and 2017, the U.S. labor force doubled. So if the labor lump fallacy was true, if the number of jobs was fixed, 50% of our current workforce would be unemployed, right? Because between 1970 and 2017, the labor force doubled. But the reality is that there are currently more jobs open in the U.S. than at any other time in history. So
I can speak to that just from the Denver perspective.
Yeah.
Our city is booming, and we have not a lack of jobs, we have a lack of workers in our city. And it's creating problems for our city because there are too many unmet employment opportunities. There's just not enough people to fill the jobs that we have. And that flies against any idea. And we have a gigantic, right, immigrant population in our city. And it flies against this reasoning that these people are taking our jobs. There are not enough people to literally fill the jobs that we have currently.
And not only that, but they, the jobs that are open are across the economic spectrum. So it's not like there's a glut in one place or another. People talk about all the openings in tech, and that's absolutely true. But there are jobs open all across the spectrum. By rescinding DACA, it's estimated that 700,000 jobs will be lost by Native-born Americans. I don't know another way to say that. I can't think of another way to say that, or I would. I don't like that term exactly, but that's what we've got. Anyway, right. 700,000 jobs, which is about 7,234 a week will be lost. And that boils down to $460.3 billion loss in GDP. So this country becomes that much less productive.
Yes.
By losing the kids who are currently in DACA. And what is interesting to know is that in the 60s, there was a massive push to limit immigration from Mexico. And I remember this because I lived in California at the time. And the states most impacted by that labor supply, California, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, those states, the supply of labor did indeed fall, but wages didn't grow. So it's not like anybody got paid more. And what that tells us is that wages grow not just based upon labor supply, but upon other floating variables. So the first thing to talk to your dad about is this idea of the labor lump fallacy. There are, it is not a fixed number. That population drives the economy. And we lose, if we lose that $460.3 billion in GDP, that also means we're losing $24.6 billion in loss to Social Security and Medicare. So don't talk to me about problems with Social Security and Medicare and then want to kick out immigrants, because they are paying more than they are taking out of the system. They are essentially, and again, a terrible way to say this, but if you're thinking about it just in economic terms and not in terms of the human cost, they're a profit center. So the next thing, point one, labor lump fallacy. Point two, immigration adds to U.S. economic growth. By legalizing not just kids in DACA, but basically every undocumented immigrant here, it makes people, it brings people into full-throated participation in the U.S. economy. They become full-throated consumers. So they have credit cards, they have car loans, they have home loans, they have medical, health, and homeowners insurance. And if you wonder why that matters, explain to your dad that medical and homeowners insurance cost less when the pool of people being covered grows. And so if it's spread out over more people, it costs less. And in terms of auto insurance, ever been in an accident with an undocumented driver? And in that case, whose insurance cost gets increased? Because it's not theirs, right? They don't have insurance. It's you.
Right. I mean,
yes. Right. Okay. So immigrants do, we know that
they... makes economic sense.
Yes. So immigrants grow more productive over time. As you know, things like their English fluency improves, their skill level increases. Second and third generation immigrants are even more productive than first generation immigrants. And here are some astonishing numbers associated with DACA. Each college educated DACA recipient is projected to add between $160,000 and $316,000 dollars in a net gain to the economy. And high school educated DACA students will add $60,000 to $153,000 to the economy, which means that just the DACA recipients alone in terms of GDP over 10 years will add $215 billion to the economy. Immigrants, and especially, so point, that's point two. Immigration adds to U.S. economic growth. Point three, immigrants, and especially those participating in DACA, add to the tax base, because I'm going to bet your dad is all about balancing the budget and debt and deficit, right? That's a big deal for him. Kids in DACA
and there's
are...
government waste, and there's you know, just overspending and...
So... kids in DACA pay income tax, their employers pay payroll tax, there's property tax, they're all paying sales tax. In other words, they're paying at the federal, state, and local level. And they're paying, as I said, on the average, an immigrant pays $80,000 more than they cost over the long term. For DACA alone, that's $60 billion. Because they receive fewer benefits than they, they pay more than the benefits they consume. And if
this is one thing that I was talking to someone at work about, which was this myth that DACA recipients can receive any kind of social safety net benefits.
Right.
They cannot.
They can't. Right? They cannot take
welfare, Medicaid, food stamps, any of it. They can't. That's not part of the DACA program.
No Obamacare credits either.
None of it. They do not receive any of the social safety nets that people who were born here receive. So this notion that, you know, DACA recipients are feeding off the system or sucking the system dry is just not true. They are not eligible for the same social safety benefits that you and I are.
And even if they
were... They still pay taxes.
Yeah. And even if they were, they're still creating more productivity than they're costing. So even if they were,
right,
they're still... an overall net gain to the U.S. economy. And the next point is that immigrants add, this is really interesting, immigrants add to American innovation and excellence and contribute directly, substantially to our leadership in tech. And if you think about this for like 2.5 seconds, you already know why this is true. But data is clear that immigrants start their own businesses and file for patents at a greater rate than native-born Americans. And this is why, this reason here alone is why all of American business is in favor of immigration, strongly. So when you saw the DACA decision released by the Trump administration, you saw basically every tech firm and every, you know, big company in the country mm-hmm. do its own version of a meltdown mm-hmm. for this reason. Because not only are those people workers for them, they are consumers. So they are valuable to American business. And by the way, if Congress does ultimately take on DACA and pass it, this is going to be why. It's not going to be for any of the, moral, ethical, empathetic reasons. It's going to be because it's profitable to American business to have them here.
That's right.
Which is, sad but true. So here's the cherry on top. Here's the last thing to tell your dad. Enforcement costs a lot of money. So that includes finding the undocumented persons, detention, adjudication, transportation, legal aid, all of that stuff. It costs a lot of money. Deportation costs around $10,000 a person. So for DACA alone, that's $7.5 billion. Just to get them out. So all together,
to deport a bunch of kids who've never known any other country. Yeah,
that's right. Many of whom don't even
people.
Yeah, exactly. Many of whom don't even speak the language of the place they're going.
Ties
yeah.
to any country that they came from.
That's right.
Right? They don't have ties to these places. They were born and raised the same that I was.
And
it's going to cost us $7.5 billion to make them go away. Because why?
Yeah. So someone said this week that they thought that we should be calling them undocumented Americans. And I thought, wow, that makes really good sense to me. That makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. So the bottom line in all of this is that the cost to the economy of rescinding DACA over the next 10 years will be at least $283 billion and more than 700,000 jobs for native-born Americans. So ask your dad. Where's he going to get those? How's he going to make that up? Where's that going to come from?
Yeah. Right.
So to summarize, labor love fallacy, it's good for economic growth. They add to the tax base. They add to innovation and excellence. And the cherry on top is that it costs a ton of money to get them out of here.
Yeah.
And that is the economic argument. And for people who cannot manage to wrap their, and that's for immigration basically as a whole. I mean, it gets, these numbers get a lot better, get a lot bigger when you're talking about, the tiny number of, 800,000 people in DACA costing $7.5 billion to deport. And you're talking about the cost of the economy being $283 billion if you lose them out of the economy. Imagine losing all of the undocumented immigrants out of the economy. I mean, it would absolutely devastate the U.S. economy. There's no question. Immigration is nothing but good for this country. We have an entire history that tells us that immigration has been nothing but a positive for this country. And
we are all immigrants.
Yeah.
We are all immigrants. Every one of us. I've got some native blood in me, but I my people came here the way that everyone else's people came here. Through Ellis Island, we're all immigrants.
That's
and
right.
We've been having this fight for generations about the rights of white men versus the rights of everyone else.
Yeah.
And it's stunning to me. I was watching, I had never seen The Gangs of New York, right? The Scorsese movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched it the other day, and there's the same battle that we're having now. What's happening in the 1700s and 1800s about native-born people versus people who are immigrants, and, you know, a lot of the same language is used. And we've been having this fight forever. And I think that what it comes down to ultimately isn't about the color of the immigrants or the... it's about racism, right? Ultimately, the immigration fight is about racism.
Yeah, it's about othering.
It just... It is. It's about othering. It's about, you know, there was this lady on MSNBC the other day who's from Canada, and she's talking about how she's a dreamer, and she's undocumented, but she's from Canada. And everyone was sort of like, well, she's fine, right? Like, she's got a job, and she's, like, you know, from Canada.
Yeah.
But then you look at people from south of the border, and it's, well, you know, they're rapists and they're one, and so it's really not about immigration ultimately, I would argue. It's about racism.
That's right. It's racism hiding behind racism.
That's so, exactly right.
Do you think it's at all possible? I mean, is it all at all possible to get your dad off of the concept that immigration is, I mean, Is your brother in a position where they can hear reason?
That's an interesting question. My dad is in a place where we started talking about immigration, and it devolved really quickly into the Antifa movement and these crazy sycophants who want to burn the world down. So I don't know that... people like him are in a position of reason, I would say. Like, he's like, yeah, you know, DACA is fine. But at the same time, in the next breath, it's the Antifa are these, like, crazy sycophantic people who are trying to burn the world down and ruin everything. And I'm like, no, they're just anti-fascist. Like, do you like Nazis?
Yeah.
And he's like, no, of course I don't like Nazis. And I'm like, well, that's all they are. They're just people who don't like Nazis. And yeah, they wear black, you know, things over their face because they're afraid of being persecuted by law enforcement for being against Nazis.
Yeah.
And we got into this very hard discussion about that. And he was like, well, we can't talk about this anymore because they'll just get mad at you. And I'm like, are you mad at me because I'm against Nazis? And he's like, no, everyone's against Nazis. I just don't want to see you, you know, walking in the streets with a thing over your face trying to burn things. And I'm like, well, that's so.
Well, but
I don't know if.
I mean, I think the response is that everyone isn't against Nazis. That's the problem.
Right.
You know?
Right. You know?
That's the, you know, including
if
our president.
If everyone were against Nazis, the Antifa wouldn't be a thing.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
And so if you want to get rid of them, get rid of Nazis.
Yeah.
As soon as the Nazis go away, the Antifa have nothing to fight against.
So your dad goes from immigration.
People, get rid of Nazis.
Your dad goes from immigration in his head. He goes from immigration. So somehow somebody has connected in his brain immigration arguments with people with black things over their faces setting fires.
Yes, that's correct.
That is just...
It's stunning, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I
called him to talk about DACA because I was preparing for this podcast.
Yeah.
And we very, very quickly devolved from that to Antifa and the protests. And, you know, I talked to him after Charlottesville, and he was like, of course, everyone's against Nazis. But he did the Trump thing. But these people are dangerous. You know, these people are dangerous, and they're violent, and they're going in the streets, and they're burning things. And I'm like, no. Like, they're protesting Nazis. you know?
Yeah.
And he's like, no, 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 they're extremists and they're leftists and they're Marxists and they're socialists and they're, you know.
Okay, but even if they are leftists, Marxists, and socialists, exactly.
Well, that's the worst thing that you can be.
I see.
I think it's worse than a Nazi. Do you see?
I see. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard.
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, it is that kind of, somehow my brain jumps from there to Rush Limbaugh saying that the hurricane barreling down on Florida is a left-wing conspiracy and that people shouldn't evacuate because it's just basically the National Weather Service making it up. To ram, yeah. You know, climate change down everyone's throat, and then himself turning around mm-hmm. and evacuating.
And saying it's for security reasons.
Yes.
And not because of the storm, and he makes up this entire story, right?
Yes.
So my dad listens to Rush Limbaugh, has since I was a kid. And, you know, his voice makes me tremor, like I can't stand him.
Yeah,
But I've been exposed to that since I was a kid. And the shocking thing, I think, is that when Rush Limbaugh says, well, we're evacuating, you know, we're not going to be able to do the show tomorrow, but it's for security reasons, because when you say crazy things, you know, people get crazy. And he makes up this entire narrative about why he's evacuating, which is not related to the hurricane. And my dad just believes it. He just goes, well, that must be the reason.
Man.
And yeah, it's really hard. It's really hard to negotiate with that or try to reason with that, right? Like, there's this sincerely held belief, like we were talking about earlier, that science is, you know, really false. He said to me one time, well, science is what scientists say it is.
What?
Okay. And
I can't even go there. I'll yell, and that's just not appropriate.
And they said, well, no, it's not. That's the whole point of science, is that when a scientist says something is the way that it is, other scientists come in and they, like, you know, peer review the science that you say is science. And if it's not true, then it's not science, right? Like, peer review and that whole part of science is what makes science valid.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, but it's just more scientists proving scientists right. And I, you know, I don't know how to argue with that. But I know that that comes from this Rush Limbaugh shit and this, you know, Sean Hannity stuff, like this notion that, like, there's this conspiracy that, like, if what you believe isn't true, don't worry about it because it's probably true and they're just lying to you. And
so
that's
there's
the, like, crux of the argument between me and my dad, is there are true things and there are not true things, and there can't, like, what is fact is fact, and then there's other things, and you can't dispute fact, right?
Does he disbelieve the evidence of his own eyes? In other words, you know, in the Denver area, there's, you know, there are all these jobs open. There's a labor shortage, as you've just described. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's pretty widely, you know, a part of all the coverage, Wall Street Journal, all the conservative press, that there are more jobs available now than at any time in U.S. history. That's pretty widely covered by, you know, everybody but Fox
right.
News. I don't know, you know, and I wouldn't know about Fox News just because I don't watch it, but
I can't either. Yeah, no.
I mean, is he not able to understand that our labor force has doubled and yet there are more jobs open? Therefore, how can immigrants be taking our jobs? I mean, in other words, the labor fallacy is plainly visible in all of the help wanted signs up on, you know, everything from McDonald's billboards to, you know, the huge long list of openings at tech companies. And you know, that doesn't take, you know, Einstein to see that. That doesn't take a scientist. That takes any person with common sense and their eyes open. So does he not believe the evidence of his own eyes on something like that?
Right. So that's another fun part about this is I live in Denver, but he lives in Windsor, which is like a pretty, I wouldn't call it rural, but it's like a suburb of a suburb of a suburb. And he, I think like many of his people vilify cities. And so when I talk about cities, I'm a city person, right? Like I believe cities are going to save the country. And he looks at cities and thinks it's just this like evil sort of den of liberalism.
Iniquity.
And so in his particular town, I don't think there are that many help wanted signs. When he would look at Denver, he would say probably, why are there so many homeless people and why are there so many jobs that need to be filled? Why can't the homeless people just go work? Right. So he looks at cities in this way that I don't look at them. He sees a homeless population and he sees help wanted signs and he says, this is the problem. Is these people are busy and they don't want to work and there's all these help wanted signs, why don't they just go get a job?
So he thinks that the guy with holding the sign on the corner when he gets off on a freeway off ramp can take a software engineering job tomorrow.
I mean,
you know, that's...
Yeah. I think he thinks that if there are jobs and there are people that don't have jobs, why is it not fixed? Without understanding that exact point. That the guy holding a sign doesn't have the qualifications for the job that is available.
Yeah.
But that's loss. Because it's all simplistic. It's all...
black and white.
There are people that don't have jobs. And there are jobs that need to be filled. Why can't that just be the solution? And any nuance is hard, you know, loss. It's hard. It's really, I mean, I've made my life about talking to him and talking to people who believe like he does. And I would say that where we are right now, it is much more difficult to talk about these things and these nuances than it ever has been.
Yeah,
because
I agree.
There's a person in charge who says black and white, here is what it is, here's what it not is, and so any sense that they had before of needing to have nuance and needing to have that conversation has been lost. Because now it's just, well, he said this and he's right. And there's no nuance anymore. And that's been echoed all the way back to somebody like my dad, that there doesn't need to be nuance anymore. Mexicans are rapists and Muslims are terrorists and women should get back in their place and gay people should stop. And there doesn't need to be nuance anymore because the president has none.
Well, I think as I was saying earlier in the show, the pendulum's going to swing back and it's going to hit him in the ass when it comes. Because the next generations, they're not going to tolerate that crap. They're just not.
I love them.
Yep.
I mean, I'm one of them, but even the generation below me, I just love them the most.
Yep.
They're the most intersectional generation that's ever existed. They understand the intersection between race and class and gender and sexuality, and they don't take shit. And I just have great hope.
I do too.
My generation and the generation that comes after me, because I really think that they are just the most brave, strong, principled people that we've seen in a long time.
Yep, I absolutely agree. So on that note, folks, thanks for joining us here today on Hopping Mad. We so appreciate having Rachel. She just, she brings so much grace and intelligence to every conversation, and we love that. And we'll be back next week. And the week after that, the show on the 25th. I will have been at the Modern Monetary Theory Conference in Kansas City, and so we'll have some really amazing interviews to come with some of the leading lights of modern monetary theory here on Hopping Mad.